keeping you current on all things criminal. This is Crime Feed. Crime Feed with Darren Kevinoki and Lonnie Coombs.
Welcome to Investigation Discovery's Crime Feed podcast. I'm Darren Kevinoki, and we are covering the ripped from the headlines cases that everybody is talking about.
And I'm Lonnie Coombs, and this is a weekly podcast, guys, so make sure that you check back every week to listen to Darren and I give our latest on all the hot topics.
And by the way, don't be afraid to tell your friends about it and use social media. You can tweet at us with @IDCrimeFeed and use the hashtag CrimeFeedPodcast, or even my favorite hashtag, dumbest criminals, because God knows I need some help with that. So, yes, we're starting with a hot topic case this week, which is definitely one to be keeping our eyes on. And that is the high school football players out of Texas who are now facing possible criminal charges as the result of some on-field shenanigans. And this is a video, and shenanigans may be kind of understating what's going on here.
I so disagree with that description of shenanigans.
So I'm sure by now you've seen the video. It's a high school football game, and initially you see the safety take what appears to be a really clear angle of just a dirty shot on the referee.
Who's standing there, by the way, with his back to this player. He's standing there watching the play. He's not moving. He is a sitting duck or standing duck.
And that referee gets blindsided. And then to add insult to injury, if you watch that video, you see a second high school football player rush in and actually spear this guy while he's on the ground.
With his helmeted head, by the way.
Yeah. So certainly there's a lot going on with this case about whether or not there's going to be criminal prosecutions. Obviously, the school is taking action.
Well, I have to say, I was very impressed that when this video first came out, that there was a very strong reaction to it, that there is immediate talk of what was going to happen to the two players as far as the school action. And also people were calling it what it is, which is an assault. I mean, when you talk about, you know, the weapon of the helmet, that's exactly what we're talking about. You've got, you know, the helmet hitting this guy who has no protection, who is totally defenseless. What I did find interesting is what everyone is saying is, well, we need to understand why, what happened. And there's, of course, allegations about why those guys, you know, the kids did it. You know, there's stuff about
definitely a backstory,
right? The assistant coach might have told them to do it, or there, you know, there's some racial slurs being said by the umpire. But I'll tell you, I believe that this is a criminal charge. I believe that once they do the investigation, it's very interesting because in Texas, football state, as we all know, there is a specific misdemeanor for assault on a sports official. The maximum is 180 days, but that's actually intended for the parents.
I was going to say,
usually the parents to run out and attack an umpire, right?
Usually there's that little league parent.
Or high school, I mean, parents.
Or in Texas, high school football.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about a serious felony here because, as we know, for a criminal charge, assault, it's based on, oh my goodness, Darren's already pulling back. It's based on the injuries. It's based on the type of attack that's made and how serious the actual action is. And I think the first kid hits him from behind, that guy's head whiplashes back so violently and goes, he could have been paralyzed by that move alone.
But he wasn't, thankfully. And they're kids. I mean, these are high school-aged kids. We expect these kinds of young people to demonstrate poor judgment in all of their affairs. That's called getting experience. I mean, you learn to make great decisions in life by having experience, and you only get experience by making bad decisions in life. So you need to make some bad decisions.
And
get
you need
some
to
experience.
Learn from those. That's exactly right. You make the bad decision, you get the consequences.
Yeah, but speaking of consequences, what about the consequences of this referee? It's alleged that he was making racial slurs. Mm-hmm. And the coach, by the way, who's the kids who engaged in this, and I'm using air quotes now, this wrongful conduct, it's not that this thought to attack the referee appears to have originated with them. This actually appears to have come from the coach or the assistant coach who said that the ref needed to pay for bad calls that they needed to get that guy, and then you layer in the allegation of racial slurs, and it's really not so far-fetched to think that these kids are responding to the direction from their coach.
Well, I don't know what penal code you're reading, but I don't know that there's anywhere in the law that says that you are allowed to assault someone if they call you bad names, racial slurs, or they make bad calls on the field. It's not a defense to an assault charge.
Well, look, maybe when we get into the world of jury nullification, it actually is when a reasonable person is going to say, hey, look, if I've now been the victim of this racial slur by this official and my coach, and there's a strong chain of command that happens on teams, this camaraderie, it's almost like a military structure where your coach says jump and you say how high. And I don't care if this guy is the head coach or the assistant coach, if you're a player, especially on a high school team, when your coach says, hey, we're going to get that guy, if you're a player, you're going to get out there and you're going to get that guy.
Well, I'll tell you, I think you are onto something. And I think more of this is going to come out as far as what was going on with that team, because it's very interesting. In this game, not only were those two players ejected, and actually something interesting happened there. They thought they were ejecting the two players that actually hit the referee. The officials mistakenly identified one of them. So one of the guys who actually hit the referee stayed in the game for one more play. And on that play, he got called with illegally hitting the quarterback of the other team, who had gone down on his knee to run out the clock, and he hit him afterwards. I mean, talk about a violent tendency kid. And one more thing. During this football game, before the pummeling assault of the referee, two other players were ejected. These were the supposedly, air quote, bad calls that the referee was making. One of them had been ejected for unsportsmanlike conduct for throwing a punch at an opposing player. And the other one was also ejected for throwing a punch at an opposing player and dissenting with an official in an unsportsmanlike manner. Now, if those are the unfair calls when they're calling them for throwing punches at the opposing player, I think there's something going on with that team.
Yeah, but you know what all of this reminds me of, Lonnie? There's this concept in the law called assumption of the risk. And what that refers to is when there is voluntary contact with a known risk, you can't complain if harm befalls you as the result of that risk. Kind of like that old adage, if you keep rattlesnakes as pets, you can't complain about getting bit. And so here you are, if we're on the field and we have such a high expectation that violence is going to happen, that we even have laws protecting these referees from violence, we have this kind of behavior and shenanigans that you're describing. Like, is it really that surprising that in this context, this referee ended up getting hit?
No, if it was an accident, if it was a quote-unquote shenanigan, it was not. There was intentional actions by both of these players to go after and get that official.
Yeah, but in a sense, it feels just a little bit to me like there's a rush to judgment, because what we've seen over and over and over again are these short snippets of the game film. And I'm just reminded of so many other scenarios. How many times have we learned that it's not what it's what you know, it's not what you think you know. And we think we know the full story just by seeing the short snippet of game film. And the more we talk about this, the more we find out about other racial slurs or the coach's direction, the more we get a slightly different picture. And I'm just urging caution that before we say, hey, let's suspend these kids, let's criminally prosecute these kids and give them some kind of a criminal conviction that's going to drag around with them for the rest of their life, like, maybe there is more to the story.
Well, let's also remember they're juveniles. It'll be a juvenile court. So as we know, the focus is on rehab, not on punishment and going to prison, etc. So bottom line, you think no criminal charges and no suspension by the school? Is that what you're saying?
I think suspension, not expulsion. I think there's an opportunity. People are talking about making this a teachable moment, and I am all in favor of teachable moments, but it's got to be proportional. And I just don't know, given the totality of the circumstances, whether anybody is well served by a criminal conviction here.
Okay, we are moving on to the Facebook story. Now, this is a fascinating ruling that just came down by the First District Court of Appeal in San Francisco. And essentially the ruling says, and this is very important for people who are on Facebook, which is like everybody, criminal defendants' right to information that will aid in their defense does not extend before trial to social networking posts because they're protected under federal law. Now, what that essentially means is if you post something on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter and later somebody wants to use that against you in a trial because you're being charged with a crime, they will not be able to have access to it until during the actual trial, which doesn't make sense to me at all. Now, in this case, one of the defendants, it was a drive-by shooting, and there's a number of defendants, but one of the defendants said that there were these social media postings by the victim who was killed and another witness who essentially was showing that they were cyberbullying or cyber gangbanging, which I didn't even realize there was such a term.
Defendants. So cyber gangbanging is what exactly? So if I'm cyber gangbanging, I'm going on in this virtual world and I am bullying the rival gang or saying
mean and making
things?
Making threats that you're going to kill, like they used to do in person, but now they're doing it over the internet. And the people that actually said that that was what was going on were the police in this case. The police said that that's how they linked some of these defendants to the actual shooting. They said that they saw...
That's how they solved the crime.
Yes, that there was this gang bullying or cyber banging, as they call it, going on, and they talked about it. So, of course, two of the defendants said, okay, we're going to subpoena the postings from Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, so we want to see what's going on. And the trial court said, fine. But then they appealed it to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said, no, there's this old federal law that's like 29 years old, the Stored Communications Act, and it protects certain things from being disclosed. And they said, during the preparation of the trial, you can't get to it. But if during the trial, if you're working really hard and something comes up that it shows that that information might be vital to your defense, then maybe you can get it.
Yeah, but my wondering, Lonnie, is you're mentioning this 29-year-old federal law that's being used to say, hey, you don't have a right to get this stuff until the trial. The Al Gore hadn't even invented the internet 29 years ago. Does that really apply to what we're talking
exactly.
about now?
And why are they still using it? It's called the Federal Stored Communications Act. It's a 29-year-old law that restricts unauthorized access and disclosure of private online information. But I'll tell you, this sounds ridiculous because, as you and I know, there are discovery laws.
Right.
And as a prosecutor, you bend over backwards. I was always afraid during trial that like one page of this discovery might be missing that goes to the defendant and they
Some
could
notes.
Use that. Right.
Yeah.
And they could use that as an issue for, you know, to appeal after a conviction. Well, I mean, it's one of the most vital rights that the defendant has.
You bet. One, there's a bit of evidence that lawyers in criminal cases talk about a lot, and that's Brady material.
Right.
And basically Brady material is anything that's good for the defense or bad for the prosecution. Anything mm-hmm. that's exculpatory or that the defense can use to effectively impeach or cross-examine somebody. So if it's good for the defense, bad for the prosecution, the prosecutor has to turn it over.
Yes.
They have an independent duty
immediately.
To turn it over.
You don't get to wait. You don't get to hold on to it.
You can't sandbag until in the middle of trial and
exactly.
then turn it over?
Oh, by the way, I just found these notes. Or we just interviewed. So you have to do it immediately as soon as you get the information.
Well, the thing to me that seems so ridiculous about this Facebook ruling is that it seems to do a disservice, potentially, to everybody who's involved in the justice system. Because I don't care whether you're a prosecutor or a defense lawyer, both sides want to adequately prepare for trial. And that only happens if you have all the raw material in hand to be able to do that. And so the idea that some of that's going to be held back until you actually get into trial seems like everybody is going to be hurt by that. And the people that are going to be hurt the most are going to be the jurors in the court. I mean, everybody should want all that material to be disclosed far in advance, because otherwise, what happens? Something new comes up in trial.
Right.
Everybody starts clamoring and saying, hey, I need a continuance. I need to investigate. There's an interruption. I need to prepare for something. Or it could be an appellate issue that arises, and the jurors, it's going to be one more time that the judge says to the jury, go back to the jury room while the lawyers fight about something. And it's going to, I think, keep the wheels of justice from turning neatly.
And the facts in this case are so clear that it's going to be vital. I mean, one of the people, the witnesses involved, and it's one of the defendants who, you know, brought this claim, his 14-year-old brother was identified as one of the shooters by eyewitnesses, and he confessed. He told the police he shot the victim because the victim had repeatedly threatened him in person and on social media, on Facebook and Instagram, and had tagged him in a video clip on Instagram depicting guns. Now, you tell me, that is so vital to his defense. As a defense lawyer, I would think you would be saying, of course I have to have this evidence.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But do you think in looking at this decision and others in the area, is there anything in the way of, a judicial leaning, anything that's protecting these online conversations?
Yeah.
It seems like that opens up some dangerous doors too.
Yeah, I think these courts seem to be a little bit behind the times on what's going on in the internet. At least they seem to be very conservative in their rulings. There was a case a few years back that a lot of people talked about. There was a guy who was threatening his wife or ex-wife, I guess, over Facebook and stuff. And he was writing things like he would not rest until your body is a mess, sealed in blood and dying from all the cuts. Really horrible things like that. So her friends alerted the authorities. A female FBI agent went over to this guy's house to talk to him. After she left, he then posted on Facebook that he was about to pull a knife and slit her throat. The FBI agent, not smart. So there's a federal law that makes it a crime to transmit any threat to injure another person. So he was prosecuted, he was convicted by a jury, and he was sent to prison for 3 years and 8 months. Well, the Supreme Court actually took up his appeal, and in June, they actually ruled that the conviction had to be overturned and that it was not fair because the trial court had told the jury that if a reasonable person would have taken those as threats, that was the standard. And they said, no, it's not a reasonable person standard. It's actually they had to prove criminal intent, that he had actual awareness of his wrongdoing, which honestly I think is really hazy, vague, and confusing. But once again, it shows that leaning by the courts who seem to be kind of in these ivory towers to say, hey, people should be able to just run rampant and say whatever they want on Facebook and the internet because we're going to protect those privacy rights and not do what seems to be, to me, just logical, which is, hey, if you're going to post such violent things like that, you need to be responsible for that.
Well, it actually appears to open up the door to more online threats. But the important thing when I think about this as a defense lawyer is it's absolutely vital. It's a constitutional right that defendants have to confront and cross-examine witnesses against them.
Mm-hmm.
And that implies that cross-examination be done effectively. And you can't have an effective cross-examination if you don't have access to the material in time to prepare for it. And as fun as it may be to do a trial, no one in the system wants to do those trials twice.
Right.
Whether you're a prosecutor seeking justice or whether you're a defense lawyer as what I call government prosecution quality control to make sure that no one's convicted unless the government's got the goods, or you are a judge trying to be like that high school football referee, just trying to make sure that the game is played fairly. No matter what your role, everybody has a vested interest in the system functioning effectively, and it just seems like this is a ruling that impedes that.
Not to mention the cost is going to be, jury trials are so expensive, so part of the pretrial prep is to make sure that everybody has all their ducks in a row. They've got all the evidence they need. You've got your pretrial motions all done. So once you bring that jury in, it moves effectively and efficiently. If you're saying, oh, we might have this thing pop up, but everybody will just stand aside as we wait for 2 or 3 days in the middle of the trial, that's just money going down the drain.
Because the wheels of justice don't turn. But there's another story that's been in the headlines lately that may be the wheels of justice turning too quickly, at least for some people. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking, of course, about the Freddie Gray settlement.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, of course, aware of the Freddie Gray case. Now it's been reported that the parents of Freddie Gray have reached a settlement for $6.4 million with the city of Baltimore. And this is only 5 months after Freddie Gray was critically injured while in police custody. And of course, you have to be living under a rock not to remember the days and days of protests and rioting. This settlement, by the way, is the largest settlement in police death cases in recent years. And of course, the timing is interesting. It happened just 2 days. 2 days before a judge is set to hear arguments on whether to move the trials for six of the officers that were charged in Gray's death away from Baltimore. So there's this whole
change of venue
thing going on. What do you think, Lonnie? A good settlement? Good policy?
No. No, I am so strongly against this. First of all, it's fascinating that the family had not even filed a lawsuit for this yet. The mayor reached out to the family's attorney and said, hey, we want to settle this. They started discussions and they came up with this number. And it sounds like a lot, and it is, but you know,
well,
just
it's a lot. It's the biggest number we've had in any of these police shooting settlements.
There was actually one back in where was it? Way back, that was like 11 million. So there's been one that's been more, but it's high. But we've got to look. You know, the Eric Garner case just settled for 5.9 million.
5.9, I believe.
Yeah. But interestingly enough, in Baltimore, since 2011, so the last 3-4 years, they've paid a total out for all of these types of cases, 5.7 million.
All
of those cases combined. So what I find fascinating is the timing of it, that the mayor actually instigated, and they did it before we've gotten anywhere near the actual criminal trial. And of course, the mayor and the family's attorney got up and said, this has nothing to do with the criminal case.
Not an admission of any wrongdoing.
Right. It won't affect it. Well, please, come on. We know that every single person in Baltimore is hearing this and seeing the huge number attached to it. The city's not going to jump on this unless they feel like, hey, they did something wrong. We're covering our bases here. We're going to, you know, go ahead and pay out before it gets any worse. I think that it totally tainted the jury pool. I think now every one of those defendants is going to have a great argument for their motion of change of venue, saying, you know, now everybody believes that they did something wrong because the mayor got up and said, you know, it's worth $6 million to pay them off. So,
I'll certainly agree with you that the idea that there would be some language that everybody is agreeing to, that there's nothing in this settlement that's an admission of wrongdoing on anybody's part, is a rather hollow gesture when you compare it to the size of that number. And I think anybody who is now in the court of public opinion and who later on may be in a court of law as a juror, it's hard to unring that bell.
Right.
It's hard to forget about a number that's that large. And it also strikes me that it's an extraordinarily large number for a city that is struggling financially in the way that Baltimore is. I mean, they are dead broke.
Well, that's an interesting point, too. If this had been filed in state court, Maryland actually has a cap of $400,000. That would have been the highest they could have gotten.
Right. But the way I'm sure that they justify settlement at this level is they say, hey, look, many of these cases go not in state court, but in federal court.
Right.
As
where
what they call
no
a
cap.
1983 action, where it's a deprivation of somebody's civil rights.
Yes.
And so that's where there is no cap.
There is
the
no
cap.
The cap
is off.
Right.
And I'm sure from the city standpoint, they look at a few things. They look at a cost-benefit analysis to say, what's a case like this going to cost to defend? And they also, I'm sure, look at how the city can heal and move on, or at least that's what they say.
Yeah, but how can you heal and move on? We've got maybe 6 trials coming up because the judge just said that these defendants can be tried separately. I mean, this case is going to be in the public's face for the next however many years. It's not like just the settlement's going to, you know, make it all go away. It's not.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that's so important, I'm certainly a fan of justice being done. And there are times when the city should open up its checkbook. There are times when they shouldn't. And what seems unfortunate to me, and maybe I just have a bias because I love a trial. I love being able to comment and watch and Monday morning quarterback and gossip and pick it all apart. Like, I'm into that stuff. But at the same time, I just wonder how much a city can heal when they just write the check and there's no real scrutiny over the behavior.
Right.
There's been no presentation of evidence. There's been no cross-examination.
Right.
There's really nothing other than this event happened and all of the riots and everything that happened afterwards. And now the city says, okay, we've got to write this check and this is how we're going to let the city heal. And it seems like unless you're willing to be truly transparent about it, which I think only happens as a byproduct of the courtroom, vigorous cross-examination,
airing of the evidence,
the full and complete airing of the evidence,
yeah.
I just don't know how you truly heal from something like that.
Yeah, I agree. And just to be accurate, I wanted to say that the other one I was talking about, the other really huge settlement, it was in 2001 in Chicago. $18 million was awarded to the family of a woman who was shot to death because the officer mistook her cell phone for a weapon. So, you know, these cases, these payouts are big. And right now, with all of the attention on police misconduct, I don't think this is the last we're going to see of a large award. But I just think that they should wait and let it play out and either, you know, have the civil trial or let the criminal trial go and let people hear more of the evidence and really weigh what's going on. Because as we saw with some of these other cases, essentially not filing charges on the officer because that once they heard all of, you know, the hands up, don't shoot. Right. Once they heard all of the witnesses and looked at all of the evidence, they said, look, what the media was putting out there, what all the witnesses were saying doesn't line up with the thorough investigation that's been done, both on a state level and a federal level. So,
yeah, but that, you know, it's so funny you mentioned that because that's what I was thinking about these sequential criminal trials that we're now going to have. Mm-hmm. And that's as the result of the defense motions. Normally, where you've got co-defendants in a case as the result of judicial economy, they'll want to try all these cases together. And the defense was successful in separating them out and saying, hey, look, part of this incident relates to just those guys over there. And part of it is these guys over here. And we want to have these separate trials. And the judge says, OK.
Yeah.
Right. So they've been bifurcated.
Right.
But I wonder in the way this plays out in real life, whether or not the specter of additional rioting and other civil unrest like we saw before, whether that looms over the trial and people who are on that jury make decisions that are driven not just by the evidence that is introduced in court, but by whatever memories there were of the civil unrest. I mean, that was really frightening and really horrific.
Well, and when they talk about the city healing, I always find it interesting that what, you know, they think it's the city paying off that huge amount. It's the taxpayers.
The taxpayers.
So it's all those people that are upset with this that are now paying out of their pockets.
You know what I'm still healing from? Mm-hmm. I don't think I've really had a real win in the dumbest criminal competition, which of course is a little competition between Lonnie and me to see who can find the dumbest criminal activity of the week. And by the way, do not be afraid to send your ideas in, of course, at ID Crime Feed. Using the hashtag Crime Feed Podcast or the hashtag Dumbest Criminals, or you could just send those ideas to me. By the way, I feel like people have not been showing me the kind of Twitter love that I wanted.
So do you want to go first or shall I go first?
No, I think ladies first.
Okay.
Chivalry is not dead in the studio.
All right. This is a quick one, pretty simple. This dumbest criminal is actually a 63-year-old felony parolee from Texas. So he had already been to prison once and clearly not enjoying his freedom quite as much as he should have. So he decides to pretend that he is a police officer. And he looks around to find somebody to target, and he sees a person standing talking to a store clerk who has lots of multiple cell phones. And he thinks, oh, that's probably a drug dealer because he's got multiple cell phones. So he goes over and he says, why do you have so many cell phones? Are you a drug dealer? Well, the guy wasn't a drug dealer. He was actually an undercover detective. But he was actually focused on what he was doing. So he ignored this guy and tried to just kind of push him away. But instead of ignoring him, this defendant, this dumbest criminal, was very persistent. And he came up to him again. He said, hey, I'm a cop. I want you to give me all of the illegal drugs that you are obviously selling.
Oh, no.
At that point, he got the attention of the undercover police officer, who then asked him for his cop identification, which apparently he didn't have any. So at that point, he was arrested and taken into custody.
Oh, no. You know, the story never ends well for our dumb criminals. That is a dumb criminal.
That is a dumb criminal.
This may be a battle royale this week. I thought I had such a great one. Well, okay.
Let's
try this. The place, Athens, GA.
Okay.
Athens, Georgia.
Okay.
Demetrius Robinson, 28 years old, had this idea. He was going to rob a Golden Pantry store late one night, but he needed to pass the time as naturally as possible until he and the clerk were alone.
Mm-hmm.
So while he's killing time there, he decides to fill out a job application.
That is back plan.
By the way, not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Except he filled the job application out using his real name along with an uncle's phone number.
Oh, wow.
So then eventually he and the clerk were alone and he robbed the store.
Nice.
Guess what? It did not take the authorities long to track him down using that job application. By the way, the sad epilogue. He did not get the job.
He didn't.
He didn't. I know.
Oh,
heartbreaking.
Bummer.
I don't know. I guess we're going to have to leave it to a vote on the Twittersphere.
Yes.
Which, as we know, thanks to the Facebook ruling, is now protected speech. So you can vote there with absolute confidence. Do not be scared. Go to @IDCrimeFeed. Use the hashtag dumbest criminals and just tell us who you think wins this one. Is it Lonnie or is it me?
I think it's a close one this week.
This may actually be a full technical draw.
Yeah.
We may be right to the end.
Whatever that is.
It's sports. Well, I've got to say, always a pleasure. Lonnie, I so enjoy the time we spend together,
too.
And hopefully the ID addicts do as well. Of course, I'm Darren Cavanocchi, and thank you all for listening.
And I'm Lonnie Coombs. Remember, if you want more shocking true crime stories, watch Investigation Discovery or visit crimefeed.com.
Keeping you current on all things criminal, Crime Feed.
Crime Feed.
With Darren Cavanocchi and Lonnie Coombs.